If you're just tuning in on TikTok, welcome to Mancy, a podcast about magic and the fucked up shit people did with it. In each set of episodes, we cover a different Mancy, blah, blah, blah. I'm RJ Walker, spoken word artist, writer. With me is Elle.
Is that going to be the intro of the podcast?
For part two, yeah.
This is it. Okay, cool. I'm Elle Alder, a professional psychic and solitary eclectic witch.
All right. So we're going to look about some haunted and bizarre locations in Salt Lake City and talk about the history and explain the legends. What we know of, at least. We'll be looking at the bizarre statue garden that features a sphinx with Joseph Smith's head, a mysterious grave in Salt Lake City Cemetery that references the devil.
Why don't you just wait a moment?
A ghost town in the middle of the city. There's just a ghost town in the middle of Salt Lake, and the hauntings reported in that ghost town. Here we go, part two. Salt Lake City Magic, Urban Legends Edition. Yeah.
Yay.
All right, let's start off with a favorite of mine. I love talking about this place. I'm so excited that we got here. It's just so bizarre, while also being so peaceful and laid back. The Gilgal Sculpture Garden. Raise your hand if you've been to the Gilgal Sculpture Garden. Y'all
really?
Are in for a treat.
You guys really haven't?
This place is
Have
so
you heard
cool.
of it? Do you know? What?
Yeah, I love talking about this place.
Okay.
So it's a secret, not so secret. Of course, that doesn't make it any less weird. In the center of the sculpture garden is an Egyptian sphinx, like a giant Egyptian sphinx. But the face is Joseph Smith's face. There's a statue of like a dismembered giant, like lying in pieces on a hill. Two stone hearts, a red one and a white one, being received by ghostly hands in a cave. And of course, the quotes.
The quotes.
Just about every rock has some kind of inscription on it. Many of them from Mormon scripture and many more are hymns. There's also some splashes of romantic poetry. It's SLC's only designated visual art environment. If you don't know what that is, visionary art is intended to tap into a sense of wonder and awareness and spirituality and mysticism in one's environment. Visionary artists you're probably familiar with include Alex Gray, who did the Tools albums. You're into Tool?
Sure.
I don't think any of you are. Alex Gray is cool art. Look it up. A visionary art environment is essentially an immersive environmental art space you can explore. Dreamscapes at the Gateway is an example worth checking out, but I guess it's not officially designated, but Gilgal Gardens is. How would you describe this place?
So Gilgal Gardens is like in the middle of it's like the 9th and 9th neighborhood, pretty much.
It's by Trolley Square.
Yeah, right by Trolley Square. And it is literally a pathway between two houses that you walk between. And then you come into what looks like almost a strange cemetery that doesn't have any gravestones. Like, it has that kind of vibe where you're looking around, you're like, oh, there's stuff that I should look at or read. There's like a little area that's a garden, and there are trees and flowers, and then a lot of like weird Mormon scripture. A lot of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like only go there, like I'll go there for like 30 minutes and then I'm good. Then I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The witchcraft in you is boiling. You're like, no, I must leave.
Yeah, they don't want me there.
The rock says nearer, my God, to thee.
It just makes me uncomfy.
So let's talk about what the fuck is up with Gilgal Gardens. For starters, it's literally in a backyard. Just a bit, like by Trolley Square, fenced off area, and there's like a fork in the sidewalk that takes you behind one of the houses and into the sculpture garden. If you don't spot the black chain link fence, you could totally miss it. And it makes it feel super secret. But like, why? Why do this?
why we have this? Why is it necessary?
Because it was someone's backyard. It was literally someone's backyard. It wasn't a product of the Park Service or the city. Just some dude just lost his marbles and built it. And that dude's name was Thomas Child. And he was actually pretty cool. So Thomas Child was a masonry contractor and a bishop of the 10th Ward. In 1945, when he was 57 years old, he received a revelation. Basically, part of Mormon belief is that God can speak directly to you and grant you inspiration. Anyway, this happened to him. Oh, revelation. That he would dedicate the rest of his life to this project.
Can I insert one thing that's like a fun fact about me? So when I lived in Laramie, I had this apartment and I was not in Utah anymore. And these two missionary kids like came to my door and they wanted to like convert me. Right. And I was like, well, I'm not going to do that, but I'd be happy to make you guys dinner and like we can have a conversation and everything. And they like came back with their whatever, their chaperone, because they weren't allowed to be alone with me because I was a woman. And
you're not allowed to be alone in general, not even the bathroom, but continue.
What?
You have to always have your companion with you.
Do you guys hold
or
hands?
Somebody. Since we think about it.
It just makes it really special. So these kids came back and their like chaperone was sitting in my living room and he was leaning against my altar. He was like sitting on the floor, leaning up against my altar. And then they were like, do you believe that your God calls you by name? And I was like, well, I'm a professional psychic, so actually God talks to me. And that was when the like whole interaction got real, real weird. It was not good. They did not react well.
So does mine.
The chaperone.
And he tells me your blood calls for vengeance, my little angel.
Like the chaperone was like staring at the ground, leaning against like my voodoo altar, right? With my like creepy fucking dolls. Like, and he just was like, wow, I just, there's a lot going on in my brain is what he said to me. And yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, Thomas Child got one of these like inspiration lightning bolts that he needed to dedicate something to God, dedicate something great to God. He would retreat from the world and begin his project. Thomas was not trained as an artist or a sculptor. No training, but he was a brick mason.
Okay.
Which relates to me a lot because my dad is a brick mason.
Mm-hmm.
He had a pretty good masonry business and he made a good amount of money with his masonry business. And he's like, I'm getting old. I'm 57. Might as well go nuts. Might as well hit the gas. So he never considered himself a sculptor until then. He would christen the site of his construction Gilgal after the biblical location where Joshua told the Israelites to place 12 stones as a memorial. It's also a name of a city in the Book of Mormon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, Thomas went hard. He went about as hard as Phil Collins went on the Tarzan soundtrack. Like, he put everything into this, constructing this arrangement of symbolic rocks in his backyard. He set up a workshop, and all that work would be done directly on the site. Nothing would be transported. All of it would be done there, and it would stay there. He would also just, like, go rock hunting. He would, like, make great pains. He'd, like, go up into the mountains and be like, I need to find the perfect rock for Jesus. I need a red
rock. Did he bring, like, the boulders down?
Yeah, he just would just, like, load up a boulder in the old pick 'em up.
I guess, like, the other thing, because so many of you haven't been, Gilgal Gardens is, like, beautifully maintained. It is beautiful. It is like better maintained than most of our city parks. Mm-hmm. Like, it's gorgeous. So that's just weird.
They had to be the perfect color, size, shape so that he wouldn't have to do as much carving. And a lot of times he was like, rocks, because they are made by God, have a natural beauty to them. And I cannot improve upon that beauty with a lot of these rocks.
And so thus he built a Sphinx of Brigham Young.
And thus the Joseph Smith.
I don't know. Yeah.
Joseph Smith Sphinx. Smith Sphinx.
Did he find that rock? Was it just like carved perfectly? And yeah, he was like, the face.
All the rocks are just rocks he found, plus like concrete and his masonry supplies and like bricks he fired.
It was a joke.
Oh.
Yeah, that was a joke.
Well.
Okay.
He did have some help from, like, he did this mostly alone, but he had some help from his son-in-law and used the funds from his masonry business to like hire help when the rocks were too heavy to move on his own. Despite the biblical and, like, spiritual themes tying everything together, there's a few eccentric, like, standouts. There's a bust of his wife, Bertha.
That's a beautiful name.
It is a very 1945 name, yes. Oh, Bertha.
I found this rock that looked like you.
I'm gonna do a special rock for you in my Jesus garden.
I just can't get over him, like, finding the eyeballs, right? Like, yep. They don't have eyeballs, but that's what I imagine.
Well, he's carved out the eye holes. He carved out Bertha's eye holes. there's also a sacrificial altar, in case you were feeling particularly Abraham that day, and a statue of himself. And his pants are bricks. Literally, the brick pants. He just laid bricks and made them his pants.
I did not know that.
I love brick pants. It's my favorite. I kind of want to get some pants that are brick patterned.
Wait. Can I say a thing that happened earlier today?
What? Oh, yeah.
We're getting ready, and like our entire day is like setting up for this and doing all the things. And we were like, oh, we're gonna head down to the arts hub at like 1 or 2. And we like ran errands early, get in the car, we like come down here, we're like ready to like load everything in. And I like look over, and RJ straight up has like the largest rip in the crotch of his jeans, like super large, like huge. And I was like, did you know that happened? And he was like, no. But this is my opener. Like, this is the opening bit. It's yeah. Crotchy the pants.
Hello, I'm Crotchy. And
I made him go home and change to have not ripped pants for y'all. But I'm sure that you would like some brick pants.
Yeah.
Because then they wouldn't get ripped. Oh, yay! It happened.
Anyway, after Thomas Child died... I skipped ahead.
Okay.
Brick pants. That's where we were. Thomas Child would invite thousands of people to see his sculpture garden. Most of them thought he was absolutely nuts. Like, what is wrong with you? What are these rocks? And he's like, these are my special rocks. Joshua
God told
put them
me.
Down in the Bible to represent the faith that they had in the Israelites. And like, yeah.
He was just way too into it, like traffic signs.
But he was like not bothered. He was like, absolutely, I'm crazy.
Oh.
Do something about it. Check out my garden.
This is Bertha.
Have a seat here. It's the sacrificial altar. Look at Bertha across the way.
Blood atonements happen here every Thursday.
Oh, my God. But his goal was to entice people's curiosity and get them thinking, which is the goal of visionary art.
Yeah.
Is to entice people to get them thinking about themselves, about their spirit, about philosophy in their minds. If you visit the garden today, I'd say that that's arousing, like 5 out of 5 stars for enticing curiosity, because it's weird.
It is very weird, yeah.
It's weird as shit. You could spend like hours like untangling the various like references and symbolism in this scripture connects
30
to this
minutes.
And this romantic poem references this Bible verse in this hymn. Like it's overwhelming almost, but very peaceful. As it is a garden. Thomas Child never stopped working on his weird rock garden until he died. Mm. Kept at it until he died in 1963. Some dedication. After Thomas died, his neighbor bought the property with the intent of preserving the sculpture garden the way Thomas would have wanted. Showing people the weird thing and then saying, yeah, I'm nuts, right? I bet this got you thinking. I bet this got your thinker thinking. And the neighbor only had it open on Sundays so visitors could stop by after church and reflect. However,
it would be really good for that, like to take the fam after church and like hang out.
Reflection spot. However, when you close things off to that, when it's like, this is only open on Sundays, and for those
and it's
those
weird, and it has a weird cave in it.
Yeah,
I want to break into it then. Like,
yeah, of course.
Yeah,
of course. You do that, and people are like, you know what? We're not allowed in there.
Gotta go.
Get the skateboards.
Yeah,
you know, that's like, what's this secret the Mormons are doing on Sunday? And because of that, it became a spot for late night loiterers and hooligans. Mostly teenagers who would tell ghost stories and do the bad things that teenagers do, like kiss and pot.
no, yeah. Not those things.
This, of course, would literally continue for decades. This would be the bad kid spot up until the millennium. In 2000, Thomas's neighbors' descendants decided that they've had enough of being burdened with maintaining Gilgal, no matter how magical. They considered selling the property that they owned all around the garden too, and making the garden itself closed off as the centerpiece for luxury apartments, baby.
Really?
Yep. Of course, when the developer showed up, they were like,
too cool.
What's this weird?
It's too cool.
The centerpiece. You know what would be a better centerpiece? A Starbucks. So we're going to bulldoze this. We're going to bulldoze this and put a Panera here.
Right next to the Sephora, right?
Yeah, next to the Sephora and the vape shop.
Yeah.
Of course, they did not tear down Gilgal Gardens, thankfully. And the main reason is because the whole neighborhood pitched in to preserve it. The family agreed so long as the neighbors could come up with the money by January 10th, like a couple days, which is when the contractor was going to show up with the briefcase full of cash. So it was like a whole neighborhood like unites to like fight the property management company. They called themselves the Friends of Gilgal Gardens and got to work collecting pledges from people. Their goal was to buy the land and turn it over to the city so that it could become a city park.
Yeah.
The city itself didn't want to pitch in because they were going through a budget crisis because of the Olympics. Like, gosh, shouldn't we do the fucking Olympics?
Yeah.
Mitt Romney says we shouldn't spend any money and we don't want Daddy Romney.
Yeah. Daddy Romney.
So it was really tough getting the city on board. They managed to get enough pledges, though, and produce enough bad press for the condo contractor.
Where is that now? Like, where's the, like, keep SLC weird stuff? Come on.
Yeah, where is that? Yeah. The condo company was like, you know what? It's not worth fighting this whole neighborhood for their weird sphinx.
Just let them have it.
They managed to officially purchase the property, and then they turned it over to the city. They received $400,000 from the county, $100,000 from the Mormon Church, and $100,000 from the Eccles Foundation. The rest of the $679,000 they spent on it was contributed by regular citizens. The Friends of the Gilgal Gardens continue to this day, restoring the garden to its original glory, repairing the old vandalism, updating the wear and tear and overgrowth, planting new plants, and outside the winter, the gardens are open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily. It's free, and it's worth a visit. So if you want to know why it's the best-maintained park in the city, it's because it's not the city.
It's not the neighborhood. City. Yeah.
The neighborhood keeps the park good. Yeah, worth a visit for sure.
Yeah, I just want to say really quick, we're going to have to ring the bowl so you can just get ready for that. We need to do this. I would have pitched in my own money to save it. We need to keep weird shit because that's how we keep our communities. That's how we keep shit like this. I'm really upset about a lot of the overdevelopment that is happening, the stupid olive apartments that I see all the time over there. Fuck that. Like, fuck all of this. Keep it weird. Donate to this shit, even if it's not for your religion.
Speaking of, if you're interested in hearing train noises endlessly, they are turning the community garden into more luxury apartments.
Yeah.
The community garden across the street.
So, if there's donations and things, that feeds homeless community people.
So
please, anything you can do to keep...
Yeah, and then tell everybody who wants to move there that the train is annoying.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Next, I want to talk about a clock.
A clock?
A clock. If you go downtown 300 South Main Street, you will see a very unassuming clock in front of the old Zions Bank. You may have never noticed this clock, but it is actually one of the oldest pieces of city infrastructure in Salt Lake. And it is the oldest piece of street furniture. It was cast in iron in Philadelphia at the end of the Civil War, and legend has it was dragged across the plains by Mormon pioneers with their ox-driven wagons, and they refused to kill the oxes and eat them when they were starving because the clock had to make it. Back then, cities needed big clocks and clock towers to give the citizens something to set their watches by. This is like the city time, right? However, you needed like a Quasimodo-ass motherfucker to like run the clock tower, make sure it was on time, and make sure everything was good, right? Not that there was a shortage of Quasimodo-ass motherfuckers in Salt Lake. It was just that we wanted to be efficient.
We're the honeybees, goddammit.
Yeah. So the Mormon city planners knew that beneath the city is a secret underground river called the City Creek. That's why the mall is called that. There's an underground river that flows under the mall. And the City Creek, deep underground, they were like, what if we had the river keep the time? So they attached a water wheel to the underground river under the Zion's Bank across from their literal vault of money to power this clock. So there's just this underground water wheel that you can go to that keeps time on that clock. It's like
how much
1800s clock.
A drought do we have to have? Like, is that a sign of the end times when the clock stops running?
It's electric now. The water is off the show
fuck.
Now.
Okay, all right.
The clock is you know, nuclear time, whatever we use.
Okay.
But yeah, if you go below the old Zion's Bank, if you're like, hey, I want to see the water wheel. And the Zion's Bank teller will be like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, next to the vault, man, I want to see the water wheel. That might be a vulnerability if you're a Batman villain and you want to rob the old Zion Bank. Scuba dive in the City Creek, like, pop up.
Actually, you just, like, jump in, yeah, at the mall and just follow it down and like, yeah, jello yourself.
The creek at the mall, that's water pumped up from the City Creek. It's still underground. That's all fake.
Yeah.
Which takes us to another spooky secret, the vast tunnel network beneath the city. The water wheel below Zion's Bank is one entrance to the underground tunnels, but there are many. Remember part one where I said that Brigham Young was like whipping everybody into a bloodthirsty frenzy so they could fight the federal government? Yeah, they built tunnels under the city to do that, to give them a massive tactical advantage and secure VIPs. And, like, secure important spiritual artifacts. The hub of these tunnels is the Salt Lake City Temple. If you've done baptisms for the dead, you've been in these tunnels. Because that's, like, they have, like, entrances there. You go down some stairs and you're in the underground. That's all connected. It goes all the way through downtown Salt Lake. If you can get through, like, the locked doors and you can just, like, navigate around downtown. Which makes a great zombie survival plan. Honestly, because you can get to Welfare Square and just have all the food stored. Anyway.
Not if you're not Mormon. No.
And, like, the tunnels, of course, haunted. Haunted. Why?
Have you been in the tunnels?
Know. Yeah, of course. I did a ghost tour in the tunnels.
Wait. Have y'all people been in the tunnels? Okay. I haven't been in the tunnel. I know about the tunnels.
You may have been in the tunnels and not even realized that you were in the tunnels.
How?
We'll get there. So
okay.
It's not like some horrible thing happened in the tunnels, mind you. It's just that spooky tunnels are spooky. You know? Some say they hear the voices of Danites telling you to leave, or see members of the Mormon militia preparing their weapons for war that would never come. Or, you know, really the only spirits I've seen down there, though, is of the alcoholic variety, baby. Utah has extremely strict liquor laws. Given that the majority of our political leadership believe drinking is a sin, up through the 90s, bars were not allowed to even have windows. And that's why old bars look weird. They just look like wood boxes. So they weren't allowed to have windows up to the 2000s. So you couldn't look inside and see people drinking and, like, your, like, little 12-year-old brain going, like, oh, they're having fun.
That's where I want to be.
I want to be a sinner now, Mommy.
I don't. There's not.
Please, I want to drink the bad boy
Never
juice.
Never have I walked past, like, a bar and been like, yeah, that looks like a good time. Well, I mean, after, like, in the, like, after the before times, like, right when we all got vaccinated, I was like, a bar. And, yeah, that's the only time in my life. Yeah.
In fact, bars weren't allowed all through the 90s. You had to be a private club for members. You were a club. Like what your dad goes to.
Your dad.
Yeah. So you had to be a member to a bar. You had to have a membership card to the bar in order to go there. Or a member had to sponsor you to get in. So they would just have people that were like professional sponsors that would sit at the door and be like, you're sponsored. You're sponsored.
Oh.
You're sponsored. Go on in. And that's why they stopped doing that, because, like,
it didn't matter.
Didn't matter. Yeah, they're like, this isn't doing anything. It's just annoying. That's the point. Anyway, this led to a big speakeasy culture in Salt Lake City. Many of the Prohibition era speakeasies continued below. They just existed in the tunnel network, like, on a regular basis. You'd, like, find your way into the tunnels, and then you'd find a secret bar in the tunnels. So when Prohibition ended, these places like continued to operate illegally since liquor licenses were hard to obtain. So they continued to be real speakeasies. And then they would obtain liquor licenses after like the 10 years it takes to get a liquor license. And over time, many of them became official bars. It was only natural since an underground tunnel doesn't have windows. So construction complete.
Yeah.
And chances are you've been to one of these old speakeasies. Raise your hand if you've been to Quarters. Quarters used to be a speakeasy, an underground jazz club called the Manhattan when it became official. But there is an entrance to the tunnels in Quarters.
Yeah.
You can access the tunnels because
I'm pretty
part of the
sure
tunnels.
If people need like wheelchair accessibility, you have to go through the tunnels to get into Quarters. Like that's. Oh, okay. I had heard that it was it's a lot. Okay. Yeah, I know, right? That's got to be wildly uncomfortable. Yeah, like accessibility is just having a stranger manhandle you, actually. So there's that. That's good.
Bourbon House. Who's been to Bourbon House?
Karaoke.
Speakeasy. Bourbon House was originally a speakeasy, and they expanded when they became official. But there's a smaller bar table that's like out of the way in the back in like a corner. That was the original speakeasy. And sometimes they, for fun, they'll like have a bartender be all 1920s and be like, pick your poison, fella. You got an alcohol prescription?
And they have absinthe down there.
They do.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all I'll say about that. That's a secret.
You can look it up online.
Yeah. Also, since there is a book festival, I should mention there is an old bookstore on Main Street, formerly Eborn Books, formerly Weller Bookworks, that has access to the tunnels. It is a bookstore in the tunnels. And that is where I accessed it when I led people on the ghost tour. I was like, here we go into the creepy, creepy tunnels. The most notable thing that happened in the tunnels that make people think it's haunted is they needed to transport Ted Bundy from the Salt Lake City jail to an airplane to expedite him to like Arizona, I think. And they were like, he's a famous murder person, so we're going to put him through the tunnels. So they escorted Ted Bundy through the tunnels to get him to the airport as a way to like secretly transport
How far do they go? Like how many miles of tunnels do we have?
I have no clue.
Oh, okay.
It's huge.
Okay.
I think it goes from like Welfare Square to the Temple to like 600 South. It's a lot.
Welfare Square would put you very close to
the airport.
1,000,000%
if you're a vampire, go for the tunnels.
Yeah. Plenty of space down there.
Yeah. Next, let's talk about the mysterious grave in Salt Lake City Cemetery. It might just be the most visited grave in Salt Lake City Cemetery, the grave of Lily E. Gray. Below her name, her epitaph reads, "A Victim of the Beast, 666. Naturally, this has triggered rumors and ghost stories amongst the young riffraff, them kiddos, them ruffians. People often leave offerings at her grave, perform seances, and genuinely freak out. Other people with ghost stories about it. I used it as part of an alternate reality game. Our roommate was playing the game. Some teenagers were doing a seance at the grave, and they were like, you want to see something cool? And then poured water on the grave, which was part of the game. And I had written a phone number on the grave in a hydrophobic like paint, so that when you pour water on it, the concrete gets wet, except for where I wrote the phone number. So you see the invisible message of the phone number. And they called the number, and they heard the secret message that we recorded for a voicemail of a woman getting attacked by the cryptid that you're hunting for the game. And they were really spooked. What the fuck? What's going on? So, what was it? A vile beast? The devil? A cryptid? One of the legends is that Lily was a member of Aleister Crowley's SLC following. And she died, like, well past Crowley's, like, prime as an occultist. When he was, like, she died when Crowley was, like, a heroin addict in a boarding house. So,
yeah.
Like, no, that's not true. No geographical way that could be and happen. Another theory is that she died on Highway 666. But there's no record of that. None of these. The beast was actually our old friend misogyny and racism.
Really?
Yep.
Wait, you could actually find out something about her?
Yeah.
Oh, so, okay. Anytime I've looked for this, they're like, oh, Lily E. Gray is not a real person.
There's a project called the Lily E. Gray Project that's dedicated to figuring this out.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, they mostly figured it out. So the truth is, Lily died of natural causes at the age of 77. Wasn't killed by the devil. She married a man named Elmer Gray at 73. Now, the civil rights movement was gaining steam, and Lily and Elmer were on opposing sides of it, with Elmer being on the racist side. When she died, of course, he blamed it on a world in decline. It's Democrats! Literally, that's the beast. Democrats. That's why he put that on her grave, to be an asshole.
So wait, he got to decide what went on her grave?
Yeah.
Why did he put 666?
Because that's Democrats.
It's not, though, but it's not.
It was to Elmer.
Okay, all right.
Elmer is buried in the same cemetery, but very far away from his late wife, like totally across the way. So nothing supernatural. He was just a misogynist douchebag.
Why did... Okay, it's fine.
Yeah, sorry, it's a little anticlimactic there. It's like Alex Jones would put that on his wife's grave. It was Democrats. 666, you were killed by the devil. Last bit of folklore I want to talk about is Allen Park, referred to as Hobbitville when I was a teenager. It's a ghost town in the middle of the city, and it is in the very heart of Sugar House across from Westminster College. Who has visited Allen Park? Sweet.
Who's gone since it's been open?
It's cool. It's cool. We're going to talk about it, and you're going to want to go. Yeah, like, it's not exactly the place you'd expect to find a ghost town. Like, Sugar House, like, the hipstery, hip, gentrified part of town is not where you'd expect to find just, like, the remnants of a lost society.
Yes, because they tear them all down to build luxury apartments.
Yeah, there's luxury apartments over
so,
the lost societies.
Yes.
But Allen Park remains. It's, like, in a deep ravine, and it's a whole neighborhood just abandoned, dilapidated, completely fenced off, left to rot. It features several small, unique little homes and a stone well, and the Parley's River, which flows through Sugar House Park, and it's, like, in this deep ravine, so it's hard to spot this neighborhood. It's, like, in a hole. It's like a neighborhood in a hole. The best view is from the houses next to it, which you can see from the backyard, and then you've got to, like, sort of do a weird hike down the ravine to sneak in there. But that's not the weirdest part. The weirdest part is that it has an abandoned zoo. Just, like, in the middle of all of it, it's also a zoo where the animals have escaped.
Wait. Why did people call it Hobbitville? Like, where did that come from?
We'll get there.
Okay.
We're talking about the zoo.
There's so many. You've said so many things and answered none of the questions that come from them, and it's a bit much, but okay.
So there's like these like empty ponds and like crumbling statues of animals and rusting away bird cages all behind like wrought iron, and we'll get later to the Wyazoo. However, those empty concrete ponds were very attractive to teenagers with skateboards. and the seclusion in the ravine made it very attractive to teenagers with weed.
Pot and kissing.
And the dilapidated abandoned structures were very attractive to teenagers with ghost stories and homeless squatters.
Yeah.
The roofs of the houses were in disrepair with vegetation and moss growing on top of the roofs. Because, like, sticks from the trees and stuff would fall on the roofs. Like, it would disintegrate and then, like, plants and weeds would grow. So they looked like hobbit homes.
Oh.
Little hobbity homes.
Yeah.
And the houses are pretty tiny. So it's like, oh, those are hobbit houses. So it looked like the Shire. It looked like the Shire if Mordor won.
Mm-hmm.
Just the hobbits are gone. And they left.
It's, pretty creepy. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And you know how teenagers are. Just like one thing becomes another thing. The wild peacocks that had escaped their enclosures and totally taken over the complex. There's like rogue, like Ronin freaking peacocks everywhere in Sugar House now because of Allen Park. Anyway, the peacocks would like roost in the abandoned houses and stuff. And so the teenagers would be like, they'd like hear rustling to be like, what was that? It was obviously
a ghost.
A hobbit.
Yeah, people would say that hobbits lived there. Like when I was in high school, people would be like, that's where the hobbits are. Like they would literally say that.
Yeah.
So,
and,
yeah.
Like teens would be like skating at twilight, doing like radical kick flips in the pond and like hear someone rummaging in the abandoned houses and just assume
it was someone.
Yeah, it was dwarves. Often, agreement from the bus doing brake check. Often these teens would try, the teenagers are shitty. They're shitty.
Yeah.
And so they would harass these squatters. They'd be like, oh, we're going to go find one of the hobbits, like go into where these squatters were trying to sleep and like poke them with a stick, like little douchebags. And then the squatters would often like shout, like throw things. They just wanted to be left alone.
Because they
want to
live some, yeah.
And a lot of it was addicts, people with mental illnesses who behave erratically. By the time I first heard about Hobbitville, the rumor was that it was a special community for people with dwarfism. And if you invaded their community, they would throw things at you. And that was a semi-effective rumor at getting people to leave squatters alone. I was like,
I remember that. Yeah, that was definitely what. I never went there.
They don't want
me
there.
I
won't be there. Like,
yeah, I'm cool. I'm cool with that.
Of course, for some reason, it drove some people further into the lore. Enticing people to investigate was like one of those like things people did. I was able to deduce that it was probably just homeless people wanting to be left alone. So I was like 17. And I'm like, is it hobbits or is it just heroin addicts?
People just want to live somewhere, yeah.
I don't know. I was, like, really hard for Jesus, but also, like, skeptical of hobbits. I did end up sneaking in, like, during the day, though. But I got, stuck to, like, the main paths because I didn't want to mess with anybody's house. And there's, like, tile mosaics all over, like, this weird mosaic art with, like, quotes from Romantic era poetry, like, all around it, mostly referencing nature and, like, animal life as sublime. And there's a kind of a spooky house with, like, a stone well in front of it, and written in, like, found rocks is the name Mary Rose in concrete. And so that's, like... Everybody
spooky.
Was like, oh, yeah, haunted for sure. Mary Rose, obviously a ghost. Who's named Mary Rose that isn't a ghost? That's a ghost name.
That is a ghost name.
So the rumor was that on moonless nights, Mary Rose would crawl up from the well wearing her rotting wedding dress, searching for a husband to, like,
okay,
drag
can
down
I
to
just,
the well.
Okay, why the fuck, like, are all these, like, ghosts, like, looking for their husbands? I promise you that's not what I'm worried about. I promise you. It bothers me. Okay, continue.
Well, the real history of Alan Park doesn't have hobbits or women in wells. It's actually really benevolent. It's actually reverse haunted, actually. We tend to think of abandoned places as haunted simply because they've been abandoned. And I figure our animal brains is telling us, like, this was abandoned for a reason. No people mean bad stuff. Do not fuck with no people place. But the truth is...
Do not fuck with no people place. That is a good rule. In like den or like when there's a lot of dead people, like cemeteries, do not fuck with the dead people place. Like, it's just leave it alone. Yeah.
The truth is, Alan Park fell into disrepair because of the death of its benefactor, George Allen. So let's get into the real history. And also, you can read about Alan Park at Alan Park. They have like the plaques that detail the history. So George Allen was a medical doctor who practiced during the First World War, and it apparently had a profound effect on him, seeing like the horrible injuries and the destruction of the land from artillery, and especially what got to him was the corpses of birds. You see, World War I, that's where we kind of started the weapons of mass destruction thing with chemical weapons and tank artillery. Chlorine and mustard gas would fill the air. Birds would just fall out of the sky by the dozens. It was horrible. It was gross. Animals would eat those birds and then they would die. It was absolutely a horror show, unlike anything that the world had seen before. So Dr. Allen was like, in 1931, was like, let's do an opposite of that. Let's do whatever the opposite of that is. So he purchased the property that would become Allen Park, and he would create something to be a refuge for wildlife, plants, and people. Dr. Allen was known to be an extremely compassionate physician. As the Depression raged, he wouldn't turn down any patients, even if they couldn't afford to be treated. The money he made in the war and as a doctor allowed him to build a place for himself, his family, and the animals. Thus the zoo. George Allen was instrumental in the creation of Utah's Hochul Zoo and the Tracy Aviary,
where most of
the animals from his property were moved to, the ones that didn't escape and become the savage
peacocks.
Feral peacocks that terrorize Sugar House and Westminster students. So Yeah, of course, all this philanthropy really left George Allen strapped for cash.
No.
And much of his time was spent treating prisoners and the poor, which wasn't exactly lucrative. So he decided to build some duplexes on the property to help sustain the animal refuge. And of course, he rented these duplexes for no more than he needed. They were, it was one of Salt Lake's first true affordable housing places. For people who were outcasted or poor. Often the tenants would trade labor working with the animals when they couldn't afford rent. It's all super wholesome.
Aww.
It's like Allen Park, super wholesome. At the time, the animal refuge would, as time passed, the refuge fell into disrepair. The birds were moved to the Tracy Aviary. The peacocks escaped and it was chaos. We are still feeling the effects of the great peacock escape.
They've bred so much. There's so many peacocks.
They happen to vibe well with Utah's climate, I guess.
Yeah.
But as Dr. Allen passed, the property was given to his family. Mary Rose is actually his oldest daughter. She passed away in 2009 at the age of 106.
Whoa.
So, like, when I was hearing about her crawling out of the well for a husband, she was still alive and kicking.
She was like, Mary Rose don't need a husband. Yeah.
Maybe she was living in the well. Do you think she knew?
Like, do you think people told her, like, hey, grandma, do you know what I heard at school?
Probably. And then she'd be like, are you my son? She was old, man.
Yeah.
She made it. Eventually, maintenance on the park was getting too much, too expensive. Eventually, the houses were condemned. Allen Park was sealed up. There were multiple attempts by venture capitalists to bulldoze the place and build those luxury apartments and Starbucks and stuff. But none of them were successful. Even as it existed as a ruin, it was an important cultural monument like Gilgal Gardens. In 2019, it was looking like the end of Allen Park in favor of a luxury apartment build that was willing to do the work and, yeah, put up some unaffordable student housing. Mostly, the descendants of George Allen were succumbing to their old age. But up to the 2000s, the place was occupied by hippies, survivalists, vagabonds, weirdos, and outcasts. George Allen's descendants did their best to operate this quaint little community of tiny duplexes that were affordable. Eventually, the houses were in such bad shape that they were deemed uninhabitable, and the property managers were licking their lips and like, oh yeah, it's time. It's time, baby. We're doing a Taco Bell KFC.
That's already there. Combo. They already have one.
Yeah, well, they
would have moved it.
They
okay.
would have moved it to the. Mm-hmm. But plot twist. They couldn't. And wouldn't you know it, technically Allen Park sits on a watershed river. Parley's Creek is a watershed river. That ravine and Parley's Creek and everything is protected land. You can't build there because you could damage the watershed. However, Allen Park was grandfathered in before they had that law. So they can restore Allen Park, but you can't build anything new there, which is wild.
Great. That's great.
Yeah. The houses could be renovated, but nothing new could be allowed. But then what do you do? What do we do?
We just have this weird
ghost town.
Yeah.
I guess skate, do heroin, skate, I don't know.
Yeah.
So it started to fall to dust for a long time. But then the city bought Allen Park. They were like, you know what? Nobody can build here anyway. We're just going to make it a park. We're going to buy Allen Park from his estate. The city of Salt Lake has been restoring it gradually and granting the public access to the main areas, but not the buildings yet because restoration is ongoing. But on October 4th of last year, Allen Park is open to the public again,
baby.
It now exists as a spooky little ghost town for you to explore safely in the fenced
during
area,
the day.
During the day. My hope for the future of Allen Park is that the structures will be restored and converted into boutiques for local artists, and that the animals will be brought back into habitats so that we can learn about them. Aside from, you know, the rogue peacocks, of course, which are still there. bring treats to bribe them if they chase you. So what the city will actually do, that remains to be seen. But so far, the restoration looks incredible.
Yeah.
So go check out this spooky little ghost town. It's amazing.
I really want a store there.
Yeah,
I really would love to have a store
there's
there.
Like the houses have a symbol on them to denote which house. So there's like Raven House and Cat House and Stork House.
They're
it's fun. Cool. So you see, Allen Park, not haunted. In fact, benevolent. Reverse haunted.
Reverse haunted.
The only ghosts there are good ones.
Yeah.
And that is all I've got. L, do you know that Utah's weirdly famous for green jello? Y'all know Utah's weirdly famous for green jello.
Were y'all here for the Olympics to see the, like, pins? The, like, the green jello pin? Were you guys, okay. So during the Olympics, I don't know why, specifically Salt Lake City Olympics, they had, like, the, like,
collector pins.
Yeah.
Oh my God, they were like Pokemon cards. We would get in fights over them.
Yes, and you would like trade them at high school. Yes. And there was the like green jello.
The green jello one.
Was a big deal. I never saw one.
So here's the reason green jello is a thing. Several reasons. For one, the marketing executives at Jell-O targeted their marketing toward the nuclear white family, which just so happened to be the ideal family in Utah. Mormons can't drink coffee or alcohol or tea, so instead of bringing beer to the party, they'd bring Jell-O. Because it's sort of like food, but not food. And because it's sort of like a communal party thing, every party had too much Jell-O. So what is to be done with too much Jell-O? Well, you get creative with your Jell-O. And so that's why there's all this weird, like, jello, green jello paired the best with savory because it's like a salty lime flavor. So with things like cheese and carrots and broccoli, it allowed people to make the weirdest, most exciting jello to one-up everybody at the block party. And the stereotype stuck, especially after the 2002 Olympics, which had jello contests.
It had contests.
Jell-O contests to see who was the champion green jelloer. L.
So bad.
A green jello with broccoli has been prepared.
RJ, like, for everyone who was not here earlier, tried so hard to do the green jello with cheese, and I straight up would not let him. I was like, that's not going to happen. Yeah, that's gross. That's gross.
It's not a missionary farewell without shredded cheese jello.
Ew.
Funeral potatoes.
Your mother's also an anti-vaxxer, so there's that.
L's going to do jello-mancy. L's going to scry the green jello. Who has a question for the jello?
I want, you do? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Oh.
Willie would like me to tell them about their gender with broccoli jello. Uncooked broccoli green jello. It's uncooked broccoli.
Jello salad. Have you not heard of jello salad?
Okay, who's going to eat this? Like, please show me someone who would appreciate the effort of cooking. It's literally melting. Like, it's not really, like, a solid anymore. There's so many things about this that I hate, and it's fine. We're here. We're going to talk about gender and Jell-O. I'm getting paid to do this, so here we are. Okay.
All right, scry the Jell-O. Use the Jell-O magic.
I don't even know, like, where to begin. Honestly. Okay, so, okay. I'm debating if, like, so we did not tell Willie what kind of, oh, Willie is the one that is helping us sponsor this episode tonight, by the way. Like, Willie is Sugar Daddy of Arts,
yes,
in Utah.
We are part
right
of
now.
The Utah Humanities Book Festival.
Yes, and so that's Willie's event. And so Willie did not know this is the kind of scrying we were going to do tonight. And also, I don't think Willie knew that, like, there would be an option to get a reading. And so to me, I think it's really kind of profound that we have a very strange combination of, like, lime green jello and broccoli with a question about gender that was, like, unplanned. Like, because I think that gender can be that sometimes where it's, like, really confusing and there's, like, oh, it should be this one specific thing. thing, or it should look this one specific way. And that there's like a lot of ways that you can do that. And it doesn't necessarily need to be appealing to other people for it to be the right thing for you. Like, those are like the primary things I get, is like, I'm not really like, your gender doesn't need to be about who's going to eat what at what party. It needs to be about like, how does Willie feel the most Willie? And there's also like this idea of a variety of size pieces of broccoli, where I feel like
is that good music content?
I'm sorry, I'm just reading the damn Jell-O.
This is why you're subbed on Spotify for the Jell-O takes.
So I feel like the significance of things being different sizes and having kind of like cut edges and then ripped parts and different things like that is that it's going to look different on different days, and that there's different things that are going to fit into different moments, and that you don't need to be the one that analyzes the why of that so much as like learning to go with that and understanding like, this is part of who I am and a part of me that I can't really understand. I'm not really sure that gender is a thing that is like inherently graspable, at least like at this current integer, like in society. And that's kind of the thing, is like being open to allowing it to shift and not having it to look a certain way for someone else, but also understanding, you know, like you can take the pieces that work for you. You could like come to the bottom and like dig through the broccoli and find the more conventional parts if you would like to do that as well. And so it's like, it's weirdly, I don't know, like having a gender question for like a weird broccoli Jell-O salad feels strangely poetic, and I'm actually really here for it because I like it.
Was that helpful?
Everyone's like, I don't know about the readings
Hold
today,
on,
but
let me give it a try.
No, don't! Oh my god! So bad. How's that gender taste? How's the gender fluid?
This gender fluid
is limey.
It's a non-Newtonian fluid. And it's earthy. The broccoli has given it an earthy taste.
You know, I feel like, honestly, I think earthy would be a good gender description for Willie. I feel like that would be, like, your gender is earthy. I feel like that could be true at this point in your life in some ways. Anyway, that's your gender through Jell-O.
Green Jell-O.
That's the next book I'm going to write. I don't haven't written a book yet, but that's the next one.
Your Jell-O, a kitchen witchery guide to terrible gender recipes and gender.
And RJ is going to narrate it in that voice.
That is our show, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out. We're on Spotify, Mancy Podcast, mancypodcast.com. If you want to go to our website, we're going to have the link up for the shirts.
Yeah, we have merch.
Up very soon. We have a few pieces of merch if you want one. And I have some of my books if you'd like to buy one of my books.
I also have an announcement that RJ actually hasn't announced to anyone. This is his book that is getting published. It has like an ISBN inside of it by like an actual publisher. There's like a picture of him in the background, or like in the back, and it's a poetry book. It says poetry somewhere. I just saw it. It's fine. So anyway, it's right here. This is coming out. This is
one
the first
galleys.
Copy of it. Yeah, and I got it today. RJ gave it to me when he got his books. He is having a release party October 17th at Dreamscapes. And this book is very different from other books. This is a combination of like different kinds of media in different forms, as well as like QR codes that you have to scan to complete some of the things to get all of the poems. So it's going to be on display throughout the Dreamscapes gallery on October 17th. So come do that with us. It's going to be really awesome. This is his first, like, a publisher published this book, which is wild. So, yeah, come do that. Come support him. Come buy this book when it's available. We do have a Patreon. We also had another episode earlier that was released earlier this week that was Queer Magic that I wrote.
Elle did that one.
Yeah, that was mine. I was really excited about it. We've gotten good feedback. So you guys can listen to that too. Follow Utah Book Fest on Instagram and everywhere else. Go to the rest of Willie's events. All of them, I think, are pretty much free. And they're really, really dope events. So definitely support other people. And thank you guys so much for coming and chilling in the cold with us. Thank you. Yay.
Do cool spooky stuff.
Do spooky stuff. Yeah.